Chapter 4. They went through the same rooms that Mushkin had passed through already. Rogojin walked a little in front. Mushkin followed him. They went into a big room. On the walls there were several pictures, all of them portraits of bishops or landscapes in which nothing could be distinguished. Over the door leading into the next room there hung a picture of rather strange shape, about 2 yards in breadth and not more than a foot high. It was a painting of Our Saviour, who had just been taken from the cross. Mushkin glanced at it, as though recalling something, but he was about to pass through the door without stopping. He felt very depressed and wanted to get out of this house as soon as possible. But Rogojin suddenly stopped before the picture. "All these pictures here were bought for a ruble or two by my father at auctions," he said. "He liked pictures. A man who knows about paintings looked at all of them. They're rubbish," he said. "But that one, that picture over the door there, which was bought for a couple of rubles too," he said, "was of value. When my father was alive, one man turned up who was ready to give 350 rubles for it. But Savelyev, the merchant who is very fond of pictures, went up to 400 for it. And last week he offered my brother, Semyon Semyonovich, 500 for it. I've kept it for myself."
"Why, it's a copy of a Holbein," said Mushkin, who had by now examined the picture. "And though I don't know much about it, I think it's a very good copy. I saw the picture abroad, and I can't forget it. But what's the matter?"
Rogojin suddenly turned away from the picture and went on. No doubt his preoccupation and a peculiar, strangely irritable mood which had so suddenly shown itself in him might have explained this abruptness. Yet it seemed strange to Mushkin that the conversation, which had not been begun by him, should have been broken off so suddenly without Rogojin's answering him.
"And by the way, Lyov Nikolaevich, I've long meant to ask you, do you believe in God?"
said Rogojin suddenly, after having gone on a few steps.
"How strangely you question me and look after me," Mushkin could not help observing.
"I like looking at that picture," Rogojin muttered after a pause, seeming to have forgotten his question.
"At that picture," cried Mushkin, struck by a sudden thought. "At that picture? Why, that picture might make some people lose their faith."
"That's what it is doing," Rogojin assented unexpectedly.
They were just at the front door.
"What?"
Mushkin stopped short.
"What do you mean? I was almost joking, and you're so serious. And why do you ask whether I believe in God?"
"Oh, nothing. I meant to ask you before. Many people don't believe nowadays. Is it true you've lived abroad? A man told me when he was drunk that there are more who don't believe in God among us in Russia than in all other countries.
Well, it's easier for us than for them," he said,
"because we have gone further than they have."
Rogojin smiled bitterly. When he had asked his question, he suddenly opened the door, then holding the handle, waited for Mushkin to go out. Mushkin was surprised, but he went out. Rogojin followed him onto the landing and closed the door behind him. They stood facing one another, as though neither knew where they were and what they had to do next.
"Goodbye, then," said Mushkin, holding out his hand.
"Goodbye," said Rogojin, pressing tightly, though mechanically, the hand that was held out to him.
Mushkin went down a step and turned round.
"As to the question of faith," he began, smiling.
He evidently did not want to leave Rogojin like that, and brightening up at a sudden reminiscence.
"As to the question of faith, I had 4 different conversations in 2 days last week. I came home in the morning by the new railway and talked for 4 hours with a man in the train. We made friends on the spot. I'd heard a great deal about him beforehand, and had heard he was an atheist, among other things. He really is a very learned man, and I was delighted at the prospect of talking to a really learned man. What's more, he is a most unusually well-bred man, so that he talked to me quite as if I were his equal in ideas and attainments. He doesn't believe in God. Only one thing struck me. that he seemed not to be talking about that at all the whole time. And it struck me, just because whenever I have met unbelievers before or read their books, it always seemed to me that they were speaking and writing in their books about something quite different, although it seemed to be about that on the surface. I said so to him at the time, but I suppose I didn't say so clearly, or did not know how to express it, for he didn't understand. In the evening I stopped for the night at a provincial hotel, and a murder had just been committed there the night before, so that everyone was talking about it when I arrived. Two peasants, middle-aged men, friends who had known each other for a long time and were not drunk, had had tea and were meaning to go to bed in the same room. But one had noticed during those last 2 days that the other was wearing a silver watch on a yellow bead chain, which he seemed not to have seen on him before. The man was not a thief. He was an honest man, in fact, and by a peasant's standard, by no means poor. But he was so taken with that watch, and so fascinated by it, that at last he could not restrain himself. He took a knife, and when his friend had turned away, he approached him cautiously from behind, took aim, turned his eyes heavenwards, crossed himself, and praying fervently, "God forgive me for Christ's sake," he cut his friend's throat at one stroke like a sheep and took his watch. Rogojin went off into peals of laughter. He laughed as though he were in a sort of fit. It was positively strange to see such laughter after the gloomy mood that had preceded it. "I do like that! Oh, yes, that beats everything," he cried convulsively, gasping for breath. "One man doesn't believe in God at all, while the other believes in him so thoroughly that he prays as he murders men. You could never have invented that, brother. Ah, oh, that beats everything." "Next morning I went out to walk about the town," Mushkin went on, as soon as Rogojin was quiet again, though his lips still quivered with spasmodic convulsive laughter. "I saw a drunken soldier in a terribly disorderly state, staggering about the wooden pavement. He came up to me. 'Buy a silver cross, sir,' said he. 'I'll let you have it for 20 kopecks. It's silver.' I saw in his hands a cross. He must have just taken it off, on a very dirty blue ribbon. But one could see at once that it was only tin. It was a big one with 8 corners, of a regular Byzantine pattern. I took out 20 kopecks and gave them to him, and at once put the cross round my neck. And I could see from his face how glad he was that he had cheated a stupid gentleman, and he went off immediately to drink what he got for it. There was no doubt about that. At that time, brother, I was quite carried away by the rush of impressions that burst upon me in Russia. I'd understood nothing about Russia before. I had grown up, as it were, inarticulate, and my memories of my country were somehow fantastic during those 5 years abroad. Well, I walked on, thinking, yes, I'll put off judging that man who sold his Christ. God only knows what's hidden in those weak and drunken hearts. An hour later, when I was going back to the hotel, I came upon a peasant woman with a tiny baby in her arms. She was quite a young woman, and the baby was about 6 weeks old. The baby smiled at her for the first time in its life. I saw her crossing herself with great devotion. 'What are you doing, my dear?' I was always asking questions in those days. 'God has just such gladness every time he sees from heaven that a sinner is praying to him with all his heart, as a mother has when she sees the first smile on her baby's face.' That was what the woman said to me, almost in those words. This deep, subtle, and truly religious thought. A thought in which all the essence of Christianity finds expression. That is, the whole conception of God as our Father, and of God's gladness in man, like a father's in his own child. The fundamental idea of Christ. A simple peasant woman. It's true she was a mother, and who knows, very likely that woman was the wife of that soldier. Listen, Parfion, you asked me a question just now. Here is my answer. The essence of religious feeling does not come under any sort of reasoning or atheism, and has nothing to do with any crimes or misdemeanors. There is something else here, and there will always be something else. Something that the atheists will forever slur over. They will always be talking of something else. But the chief thing is
that you will notice it more clearly and quickly in the Russian heart than anywhere else. And this is my conclusion. It's one of the chief convictions which I have gathered from our Russia. There is work to be done, Parfen. There is work to be done in our Russian world, believe me. Remember how we used to meet in Moscow and talk at one time? And I didn't mean to come back here now. And I thought to meet you not at all like this. Oh, well. Goodbye till we meet. May God be with you. He turned and went down the stairs. Lyov Nikolaevich! Parfen shouted from above when Mushkin had reached the first half landing. Have you that cross you bought from that soldier on you?
Yes.
And Mushkin stopped again. Show me. Something strange again. He thought a moment, went upstairs again, and pulled out the cross to show him without taking it off his neck. Give it me, said Rogozhin. Why? Would you... Mushkin did not want to part with the cross. I'll wear it, and give you mine for you to wear.
You want to change crosses?
Certainly, Parfen. I'm delighted. We will be brothers. Mushkin took off his tin cross, Parfen his gold one, and they changed. Parfen did not speak. With painful surprise, Mushkin noticed that the same mistrustfulness, the same bitter, almost ironical smile still lingered on the face of his adopted brother. At moments, anyway, it was plainly to be seen. In silence at last, Rogozhin took Mushkin's hand and stood for some time as though unable to make up his mind. At last he suddenly drew him after him, saying in a scarcely audible voice, "Come along." They crossed the landing of the first floor and rang at the door facing the one they had come out of. It was soon opened to them. A bent old woman wearing a black knitted kerchief bowed low to Rogozhin without speaking. He quickly asked her some question, and without waiting for an answer, led Mushkin through the rooms. Again they went through dark rooms of an extraordinary chilly cleanliness, coldly and severely furnished with old-fashioned furniture under clean white covers. Without announcing their arrival, Rogozhin led Mushkin into a small room like a drawing-room, divided in two by a polished mahogany wall with doors at each end, probably leading to a bedroom. In the corner of the drawing-room by the stove, a little old woman was sitting in an armchair. She did not look very old. She had a fairly healthy, pleasant round face, but she was quite grey, and it could be seen from the first glance that she had become quite childish. She was wearing a black woollen dress, a large black kerchief on her shoulders, and a clean white cap with black ribbons. Her feet were resting on a footstool. Another clean little old woman, rather older, was with her. She too was in mourning, and she too wore a white cap. She was silent, knitting a stocking, and was probably some sort of a companion. It might be fancied that they were both always silent. The first old woman, seeing Rogozhin and Mushkin, smiled to them, and nodded her head several times to them as a sign of satisfaction. "Mother," said Rogozhin, kissing her hand. "This is my great friend, Prince Lyov Nikolaevich Mushkin. I've exchanged crosses with him. He was like a brother to me at one time in Moscow. He did a great deal for me. Bless him, Mother, as though it were your own son you were blessing. Nay, old mother, like this. Let me put your fingers right." But before Parfen had time to touch her, the old woman had raised her right hand, put her two fingers against her thumb, and three times devoutly made the sign of the cross over Mushkin. Then she nodded kindly, affectionately to him again. "Come along, Lyov Nikolaevich," said Parfen. "I only brought you here for that." When they came out onto the staircase again, he added, "You know she understands nothing that's said to her, and she didn't understand a word I said. But she blessed you, so she wanted to do it of herself. Well, goodbye. It's time you were going, and I too." And he opened his door. "'At least let me embrace you at parting, you strange fellow,' cried Mushkin, looking at him with tender reproach, and he would have embraced him. But Parfion had scarcely raised his arms when he let them fall again. He could not bring himself to it. He turned away so as not to look at Mushkin. He didn't want to embrace him.
"'Don't be afraid. Though I've taken your cross, I won't murder you for your watch,' he muttered indistinctly, with a sudden strange laugh.
But all at once his whole face changed. He turned horribly pale. His lips trembled, his eyes glowed. He raised his arms, embraced Mushkin warmly, and said breathlessly,
"'I'll take her, then, since it's fated. She is yours. I give in to you. Remember, Rogozhin.'
And turning from Mushkin without looking at him, he went hurriedly in and slammed the door after him.